this, there are probably too many lawyers. Well, if we believe in the free market and there are plenty of lawyers, you'd think that, geez, if lawyers were making so much money on this, there'd be two things. There'd be an awful lot of lawyers doing personal injury work, whereas if you look at the stats, it's a real few, very few that actually do it because it's so high risk, and you go for years without making any money to feed your family. That's number one. And number two, you'd think that besides more people doing it, they'd be doing it for less than 30%, less than 25%. You know, well, bring your big case to me, I'll do it for 10%. It doesn't happen. And the reason it doesn't happen is not because lawyers are sitting around sort of setting their rates. It's because, in fact, you can't do these cases efficiently without those sorts of percentages. So the whole system has been built up in a way to make sure that when the awards are made, there will be enough to compensate the victims. What you can do to change it, I don't believe that there's anything you can do to change it that won't interfere with the free market and allowing people their own choice of attorneys. I don't really think so. But the other thing that I want to say is this. I really disagree based on my experience and all the statistics that I know, and concluding with my work with the Commission on Uniform Laws, that indicates that I really quarrel with the statistic that only 40-some percent is ending up. Yeah. I mean, I think that it's, certainly in my experience, it's much higher. It's much more like 75% is ending up with the injured party. And certainly in tough cases, well, then it's going to be more like 65 or 70. Where in those cases where the lawyer, you know, takes a one-third. But I would say that if you really want to make sure that these cases settle quickly, then the committee should consider doing something to increase the hammer against insurance companies. And you've heard some of it today, and I could tell you stories that would turn your hair. But I wanted to show you this instead. That would make it dangerous for insurance companies to stonewall, to starve out. And that's exactly what they do. They starve out people. They make them desperate. They wear them down, even through their litigation tactics. What they were trying to do with Fred here, the older guy, they were expecting him to die. And they knew that it was really hard on the family. He had a house that wasn't wheelchair modified. They didn't have a lot of money for wheelchair modifications. So they figured that finally he'd come to them through me and say, please, what will you give us? He needs some money. Will you give us $300,000? Will you pay his medicals and give us $500,000? Whereas they knew that his lifetime medical care costs would probably exceed that, but, well, then he was eligible for some Social Security, et cetera, et cetera. They were nickeling and diming and really tried to starve him out, and it was really tough on the family. And the same thing going with Felipe Sosa. Felipe was, his mother assumes his care. I mean, basically, she does it all. And, but there are a lot of mothers who, because they have to work or do something else, might not be able to do that. Felipe's mother was a housekeeper at the Sheraton, and she quit her job so she could look after him full time. And Felipe's father basically is the one that paid enough prior to that case settling to make sure that she could live and be his full time healthcare provider.
You know, we have a provision in here that Felipe's family, having paid money to support Felipe, that if this bill passes, that Felipe's judgment would be reduced by the amount of money that his family had paid, because that's a different source of funds.
That's correct. Yes.
You haven't commented on that. Well, and that's a fascinating thing, too. If you're so busted up, your family has to care for you, this bill is so kind that the amount of money your family paid to take care of your care is deducted from your judgment, and your negligent wrongdoer who yes. caused the injury gets credit for that.
Yes. I mean, Senator Taylor, you've put it so effectively. I could talk to all of you about this bill and the provisions in it for hours. I know there are others who are going to talk about different provisions, and you've been very kind to give me as much time as you have. Of course, I think that's abhorrent. It's a great injustice, and I don't know what else to say about it. I've lived with these families. Fred's family, they were personal friends of mine. Fred, by the way, this injury occurred in 1984. He died last year, and he died of complications resulting from his high paraplegia. Felipe is still alive. Anybody who wants to see him, anybody who doubts that he's there mentally, I'll have his mom bring him in here. In fact, I thought about it today, but I expected, and I guess correctly, that there wasn't enough room. And the other thing is that I think that the family was kind enough to say, yes, go ahead and use this, but I think it'd be very hard on her mom, on his mom to be here with him, and perhaps on Felipe, although he can't express himself, as you've seen, to know about people seeing what his day-to-day life is. If he came in here in a wheelchair, he wouldn't say anything. He'd just be watching.
These two men, if the bill were to pass, their case would be worth how much for the non-economic aspect?
No more than $500,000. No more than $500,000. I don't. Somehow, you know, my value system got pegged about 1966 or 67 when I got my first job, and I remember my father telling me that the guy down the block was making $45,000 a year, and we thought that was a lot. And then I find out, you know, what has happened to the prices of things in my lifetime, and I'm probably about half, my life's probably halfway over, and I think for somebody like Felipe, by the time he's my age, what the prices of things will be. And it may be very likely when we say, God, $500,000, that's all you got? I mean, I remember when I first moved up here, $100,000 house in Alaska. My God, he lives in a $100,000 house, you know, over in some nice part of town. Well, geez, you know, someday I'd like to be able to have something like that. $100,000 houses doesn't buy much. I mean, $100,000 doesn't buy much. Well, that's the reality. And I think that $500,000 is truly, it's wrong, and it should be left to juries. And if, I'm certainly not, I want to say one other thing. I've heard of outrageous verdicts. Yes, whether we've heard any of outrageous verdicts here in Alaska, you bet. Unfortunately, I had a client that suffered one last January. She was hit by a drunk driver who was three times over the limit. She had serious back problems. Even the defense doctor said, yeah, she was seriously injured. I hope that, he said 2 years after the injury, I hope her problems would clear up within a year. She went to doctors and physical therapists over 2.5 years before trial, 113 times. They stipulated to her medical expenses. They said, just before trial, they said, okay, you don't have to put on medical testimony. We'll give her the $13,000 in her medicals. We'll give her the $2,000 in her lost wages. She did everything she was supposed to do at physical therapy. All the physical therapists said, yep, she was cooperative. She's not a whiner and a complainer. The jury came back and awarded her, for her pain and suffering and loss of enjoyment of life, $8,500. $8,500. And there's no determining how long her problem is going to last. Now, I think that's outrageous. But you don't see judges coming in saying, oh, like they do with big compensatory awards, saying, well, I think, you know, this is too much. We're going to cut this by 50% like they did with this McDonald's thing. You heard about that. And other judges have decreased awards here. No, they say, well, Jesus, jury, I mean, they heard the evidence and $8,500. You hear more stories about verdicts like that than you hear about so-called outrageous or runaway verdicts. In fact, I'm not aware of any outrageous or runaway verdict ever in this state in terms of a high number. Outrageous in terms of a low number, plenty. Many. Thank you. Senator Taylor?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to stop the committee.
I have no more questions. Yeah. We had a gentleman here that was earlier with the President of the Trial Lawyers Association. If there is some dispute of these numbers that we have from this actuary firm that says that these numbers are not true to Alaska.
Yeah, I'd like to
get
them
some numbers so that
Jeff,
we can
would
have
you work
actual,
on it?
So we can have, you know, data on both sides.
Yeah. I think my committee's taking a rest break here for a moment. It's very obvious to me, to those here and those online, that we're going to have to start really limiting ourselves in these comments, and I don't want to limit one side and as opposed to limiting another. And as a consequence, if necessary, I'm prepared to sit here with the committee and go all afternoon. We're only going to go until noon, but my time is going to be
just
yours.
Just written forms.
Yeah, the question was...
My understanding of those numbers, and I haven't seen the specific ones you're referring to, my understanding was that the notion that 60% went to litigation costs represented the combined expenses of defense counsel, plaintiff's counsel, and cost of litigation.
Yes.
Obviously, you know, plaintiffs have no control over how much insurance companies spend to defend a defendant, and in my experience, defense costs in litigation usually are about or slightly more than what plaintiff's litigation fees tend to be in a similar case. So if you ask me, what can we do to make sure that a larger percentage total of the dollars that are spent for compensation or litigation or claims resolution actually wind up in the pockets of victims, there are a couple of things you could do. What Grant said about putting a hammer over defendants is quite right. If, for example, for all the whining about contingent fees, if defense lawyers worked on contingent fees, which is to say you make an offer, you have to make an offer within the first 30 days of a lawsuit, and if the defense counsel doesn't then beat that offer, you know,
he suffers nothing,
or alternatively he gets a percentage of everything he's able to save the company less than the plaintiff's offer, I guarantee you'd see defense counsel allocating their time and resources a lot differently. Right now, and I can say this, earning a substantial part of my livelihood as a defense lawyer, but right now the system functions to reward at least defense lawyers, if not defendants themselves, for dragging their heels. The more hours you work, the more money you make. I mean, I'm not saying that all defense counsel are unconscionable and unethical, but the system doesn't put much of incentive or a gun to my head as a defense lawyer to get this case over with real quickly. If you had a provision that said that the prevailing party in a lawsuit recovers his or her actual attorney's fees incurred in prosecuting the claim, that would add an additional incentive because the defender or the insurance company know they're going to be on the hook not only for the damages but for the costs that are incurred as a result of driving that litigation for 2 years. And the cost of driving litigation in that fashion is a cost that's borne not, I think you need to keep this clearly in mind, it's a cost borne not just by injured Alaskans. Significantly, it's a cost that's borne by the entire state because the court system is geared up to process cases in a certain way. We spend millions and millions and I saw Chris Christensen from the court system here earlier. I'm sure he can confirm this. We spend a ton of dough on the court system's budget, and a substantial part of that budget is the cost of keeping the average civil lawsuit in the state alive for 2.5 to 3 years. If you could shorten that time to 6 months or 9 months for claims resolution, you know, you would do a great service for all of Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did not mean
to interrupt. No, that's fine. Very good question, and I hope you will follow up with something on that. And in fact, I would really appreciate hearing suggestions, affirmative comment that could be made in this bill for methods by which we can start reining in this huge cost of litigation that Senator Miller was referring to. I jokingly said to some people the other day that we ought to put all defense attorneys on a contingent fee, and then this entire thing would get resolved damn quick, because the faster they can get it resolved, the faster they get paid or don't get paid. Unfortunately, only one side of the civil litigation argument works on the contingency that they're right. The other side gets to work hour after hour after hour after hour, whether they're right or not, and can create one specious defense theory after another, and Lord knows I've seen them all after 6 years on the bench. But my thought was, why don't we set it up in our laws, we could do this, State of Alaska, that at the end of the suit, when the defendant has been proven to have been wrong, and probably should have settled the thing years before, if not months at least, that the winning party has the choice of either being paid pursuant to Rule 82 or they get paid exactly the same amount that the defense attorney got paid for doing that litigation. And interestingly enough, a friend of mine said, I've already been doing that. I go in and I ask for my Rule 82 fees, which are going to be about 30%. The insurance company comes in and says, oh, those are outrageous fees. You put in way more time than you should. He said, so then I just turned around and subpoenaed their records and asked them to show the court what was reasonable cost for defending this suit. He said they settled immediately. They were happy to pay the one-third because they certainly didn't want to come in and show how much they'd billed Piece of the Rock for the phony defense they put on over a 3-year period that cost Piece of the Rock $2 or $3 million. Interesting. If we were all owners of these insurance companies in this room, we would never tolerate the type of stuff that's being done to us and on behalf of us in these courtrooms.
I'd love to put all of them on contingency basis, contingent fee basis. Grant, thank you very much. We took way longer. We
Senator should've. Taylor, would you like me to, would the committee like these for any reason?
I don't even like to look at them.
I will make them available should anybody want.
I've just suffered through that process with a loved one of mine. I can certainly attest to the impact of bed sores and what devastating effects they have on the patient. Henry Springer, you're up next, Henry. Please raise your right hand. Swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, help you God.
I do.
Thank you.
I don't know why you're swearing me. It don't work too good. Last few guys said they would be brief, and they were 45 minutes on the oath. My name's Henry Springer. I'm the director for the Associated General Contractors, a 550-member organization representing the construction industry in Alaska. I'm on the oath, and I'll be brief. I'm here to testify in regards to House Bill 158, and I want to specifically address Section 2, that's the statute of repose. We, in general terms, support that whole bill, and we have specific interest in, naturally, in that statute of repose. It's suggested at 8 years. I think 8 years is plenty. Most requirements for record keeping and so on in the construction industry are limited to 7 years. That includes all the labor records, payment records, and so on. That's both by the IRS and by federal requirements, so there are hardly any records of any kind around after 7 years. The second thing is that there are sufficient safeguards in the present procedures that involves the designers, the owners, the inspection requirements before a project can be released, and all the other things which are intentional or reckless disregard, fraudulent, or so on, which would could be construed as being built in, they are exempted in that bill. It was raised if it was a question of constitutionality. I'm confident that 8 years would stand muster. There are many states that have less than that, and even so, I'm not an attorney and not familiar enough with the Alaskan specific requirements. I think 8 years is a very reasonable time. End of my testimony.
Thank you. Questions for Henry? Representative Springer, it's always good to have you back before us. Thank you. We have had several other sites online for some time, and I would like to briefly bounce to a couple of them. They've been waiting a long time also, some of them a couple days. With that, I would like to ask if we have anybody online at this time in General Alaska. Can you hear me? Or is there anyone online in Juneau, Alaska?
Yes, sir. We have Susan Miller here to speak with you, Senator.
Thank you. Please proceed, Susan.
Thank you, and I'll try to be brief.
I'll consider your testimony as having been sworn, since I can't see you and have you raise your hand there. Go forward.
Okay. I'm going to read a prepared statement. It's pretty brief. I'm a victim of medical negligence, and I want to give you some historic perspective what happened to me, and also how the new so-called tort reform bill would have affected my chance of recovery had it been enacted at the time of my injury. To say the least, the proposed changes in our tort system would have catastrophic effects on people in situations similar to mine. In June of 1991, I was employed by the state of Alaska in a job that I just loved. I traveled all over the state to remote communities, and it required a significant degree of mobility. I was and am happily married and the mother of four children. As their mother, I was active in their lives, including participation in their activities, both in school and in sports. In June of 1991, my life as I knew it came to an end. On June 19th of that year, I began experiencing severe low back pain, which prompted me to call a local orthopedic doctor here in Juneau. I was told by his office that he did not accept patients except by referral from a family physician or the emergency room. As a result, I left work and reported to Bartlett Memorial Hospital Emergency Department. Once there, I was examined by the emergency room physician, given pain medication, muscle relaxers, and sent home for bed rest and a prescription for physical therapy. 2 days later, the pain became unbearable. I went back to the emergency department and was examined again by the same doctor. By this time, I was experiencing neurological deficits, including numbness in my lower extremities and difficulty walking. The emergency department contacted the same orthopedic surgeon with whom I'd attempted to schedule an appointment two days earlier. The emergency room doctor was talked out of a CAT scan and was instead told to fax over my records and to advise me to come to his office the following day. She did so, and before I left the emergency room, prescribed stronger pain medication. When I went to the orthopedic doctor's office the following day, his staff acknowledged receipt of the records but refused to schedule me for an appointment until the following August. It was about 3 months. Believing that I must be overly concerned or overreacting about my condition, I scheduled the August appointment and followed the emergency department doctor's prescription for physical therapy. The pain continued to increase and I continued to experience more neurological loss. On the evening of June 22nd, I telephoned the emergency department at the hospital and explained what had gone on for the course of that week. I explained to the on-duty doctor and nurse my existing symptoms and the fact that the pain was growing unbearable. Instead of telling me to come in, I was told that there was nothing more that they could do and I should contact my family physician the following Monday. By the following day, my legs were growing increasingly numb, and when I tried to get up out of bed, I fell. I could not walk or stand. I finally spoke to a doctor who told me to report to the emergency department where I was examined and admitted. Despite clear and unequivocal signs of a condition known as Cotta Aquina syndrome, I was never advised that no one in Juneau could perform emergency or other back surgery, nor of the severity of my condition. Despite my condition and having been told of my symptoms and the examining doctor's findings, the orthopedic surgeon did not examine me until approximately 24 hours later. I basically lied in the hospital in a bed and saw no one. By that time, I had lost all bowel and bladder control and had no feeling in my left extremities. I was in effect diagnosed with saddle anesthesia, which I will describe in a moment. The next day, I was advised by the orthopedic surgeon that he could not treat my condition and that I needed to be medevaced to Anchorage or Seattle. I had to wait several more hours before a medevac flight could be dispatched from Seattle to Juneau. I was then flown to Harborview Medical Center in Seattle, where I was operated on the following afternoon. Due to the orthopedic surgeon's failure to schedule me for a timely appointment, the emergency department's failure to do adequate follow-up or to advise me to come in immediately, and due to the admitting doctor's failure to recognize my condition, I have now been rendered an invalid for the rest of my life. I have to walk with the aid of an ankle brace and walking device. I still suffer from partial bowel and bladder incontinence. For the rest of my life, I will suffer from sexual dysfunction due to the saddle anesthesia, from which I have never recovered. In plain terms, this means I have no sexual feeling whatsoever. After 3 years of independent medical examinations, embarrassing depositions, and my expenditure of over $100,000 out-of-pocket costs, for expert witnesses and deposition trips, the offending doctor finally agreed to settle this case. Believe it or not, their defense was that I had not followed their directions. Although this is laughable, they literally retained experts from the four corners of the globe to testify that none of the doctors in question did anything wrong, or even if they had, my condition would be the same. While I don't think that any jury would have agreed with them, they put me and my family through an expensive, humiliating litigation process and attempt to wear me down both economically and emotionally. But for the courage and support of several medical doctors who were willing to come forward on my behalf and the hard work of my attorneys, they might have prevailed. It's my understanding that this legislative body has suggested capping non-economic damages at $300,000. Given the extent of my injuries, such an award for my permanent dysfunction and disfigurement would have been a travesty. The wrongdoers in this case only settled this matter out of fear of how the jury would value the consequences of their negligent acts. To remotely suggest that being rendered sexually dysfunctional at the age of 43, to suffer bowel and bladder incontinence in public and in private, to be forced to operate my car by the use of hand controls, and to walk with the aid of corrective devices because of someone else's negligent acts is unconscionable. If I could have my life back and enjoy those things that you on this committee take for granted each day, I would gladly refund the settlement I received in this case and, when it's back, sell everything I owned and pay any price to achieve my pre-injury status. The legislature's attempt to protect wrongdoers, insurance companies, and those most able to be held accountable for their wrongdoings will not go unnoticed. Attacking lawyers may be fashionable, but the real victims in these cases are people like me and others in similar situations. Suggesting that the quality of one's life would be relegated to the sum of $300,000 is an insult to the integrity of our entire civil justice system. After all, juries are comprised of 12 people just like you and me. The hear the evidence, they see the results of other people's actions, and they alone make the decision as to the effect of a given injury on a given plaintiff's life. Leave the system alone unless you can improve it. The statute does nothing to improve the plight of countless victims in this state who needlessly suffer because of the negligence of others. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. I think there was one other witness, at least on my printout here. There's one other witness shown in Juneau.
Yes, good afternoon, Senator Taylor. My name is David Otness, and I think the preceding testimony should have opened a lot of people's eyes. I will not and cannot claim that my injuries are anywhere approaching the extent of this woman's. However, over the span of 25 years, I've had three injuries to my neck, and each one has been debilitating to the point where I've lost work time and had the sad experience of having insurance companies dictate my life and go out of their way to accuse me of being the neglectful party when, in fact, each time I was injured by somebody else's negligence. Rather than give you extensive background on that, I did fax up a letter I sent to Ms. Brenda Allen, Senior Claims Adjuster of Allstate Insurance Company, regarding an automobile accident in which I was involved at Ock Bay on June 25th of this year. Essentially, the letter documents my condition and lack of anywhere to turn as a result of this accident, and I was hoping to get some response out of her. Well, it is now the 24th, and I was coincidentally writing a letter to her this morning, and I'll read you this. I'll try to keep it real quick. Dear Ms. Allen, at this point in time, I'm rather befuddled at best while I wait for the wheels of fairness to turn and allow me to get some direction back in my life. I'm truly at the end of my rope on one hand. Yesterday, my dignity took a major blow when I went downtown and applied for food stamps. I have no other recourse. Now I don't even have money for bus fare, money for laundry, showers, etc. This situation, not my fault, has reduced me to penury and the self-esteem of one living under a railroad bridge. I come from some of the hardest working stock to ever settle in Alaska, and have followed the footsteps of two generations of commercial fishermen out of Petersburg. We're self-reliant by nature, no handouts, please. Why am I sitting here without some tangible form of assurance that this disruption, uncertainty, pain, and financial disaster do not at some point have an end beyond that promised by death? I take into consideration the fact by law you are not obligated to compensate me while the case incident remains unsettled. And therefore, the $1,000 advance that served to stave off my poverty until now was appreciated. But I have still had to sell certain assets to feed myself and make token payments on substantial bills. Now I must buy these things again at higher prices and continue to go deeper into the red. What kind of a system is this that leaves victims of injury inflicted by insured parties to hang out on a limb such as this? The platitudes expressed in your Allstate form policy first letter to me of June 27, 1995, and the enclosed good hands pledge has not been addressed as promised. I have not been kept informed throughout the claim process. I have patiently awaited for word concerning this. Agent Tom Drake advised me on July 18 that I should expect a settlement offer imminently as the next step after I gave my deposition on July 18th. I waited until August 10th and had my brother call, and once again was advised contact was imminent. Day marks 2 months since the accident, and I have not heard from you. On my brother's advice, I spoke with his employer, Senator Robin Taylor, for almost 2 hours last week, and as you know, he is no friend of tort reform and, by extension, the insurance industry. The cases he cited did not give me any sense of optimism for pursuing this matter without an attorney. He advised me to contact Jeff Jefferson in Kenai, and I did. At this juncture, I'm wavering on filing a lawsuit through Mr. Jefferson only because I several times stated aversion to bringing attorneys into this case. However, I do not intend to lose my extensive investment in time and money in my boat and occupation, and therein my best personal interest, just because of the potential time and inconvenience of dragging this to court. I have already lost 3 fisheries this year as a result of this accident, and they represent the majority of my income potential for the year. Now with winter coming and my physical debilitation a more prominent factor because of deteriorating weather conditions, I cannot begin to assess my capabilities to pursue my occupation safely and productively. What gives here? June 24th is an accident. Your party has insurance. He admitted responsibility on scene. My sister-in-law's car was insured. I was legally making a left turn with turn signals on have witnesses, phone numbers, and police reports. July 7th, I provided you with all materials requested, medical records, wage statements, and a personal account of my living condition. Pain and duress I was subject to while trying to take care of these things for your company's edification. Sent them certified mail, return receipt request, attention, Brenda Allen. July 10th, I got the receipt stamped in Anchorage from Allstate. July 18th, I called you and you stated you had not received my information. I flipped and berated you for not giving me assistance and told you that three attorneys interested in my case just from hearsay. Mr. Tom Drake, your agent, was at my boat within an hour, and within 5 days I had contingency money of $1,000, which bought food, doctor appointments, medicine, transportation, paid one quarter of my mortgage bill, which will be up to $1,000 as of September 1st. I'm still numb in my left arm and have pain. I cannot work. Ms. Allen, I walked 12 miles from Ark Bay to Juneau to sign up for food stamps on August 22nd. I had $1.30 in change for the bus ride back to my boat. I wrote in the application for food stamps that I considered the food stamps alone and would reimburse the state when I received a settlement. If I could not get the assistance under those terms, I would have refused them, gone without food, and immediately contacted Rush Limbaugh or someone similar for on-air expiation of all my frustration with this old system to treat honest, hardworking people with such disdain. I was advised this is just the way the system works. In other words, insurance companies have the right, even when clearly responsible to injured parties, to withhold contingencies, survival payments, thereby giving an aggrieved party one option to settle on our terms or hang yourself until we have ignored you in a submission. This is by and large the pattern I have noticed, Ms. Allen, and it is increasingly evident to me that your good hands have a significant middle digit presented to my sorry ass. Since the chef did I try to avoid a sour vinegar approach and one last attempt at settling without litigation, this is as close as I can manage. Your humble and obedient servant, David J. Otten. Ending this, the only court reform we need is that in favor of the injured parties. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Otis. Any questions? Thanks again. I'm going to return up to Homer for a Denise Beach.
Denise Beach. I am but one representing the many women affected by breast implants. We are a clear case of business profiting at the expense of others. Companies, whom it has been proved, knew the product they were manufacturing was and is harmful. Documents have been uncovered proving this. We were victimized by the company. We asked all the right questions prior to being implanted and were given all the right answers. I myself considered and gathered information for 8 years prior to proceeding with the surgery. Had the major manufacturing companies made public the results of tests they themselves conducted, I can assure you women would not have gotten their implants. I know I wouldn't have. At this point, as compared to some I know of, I am lucky. I only have connective tissue disease, Raynaud's phenomenon, fibromyalgia, lymphadenopathy, photosensitivity, irritable bowel and bladder, blood in the urine, difficulty swallowing, joint arthritis, osteoporosis, irregular heartbeat, hair loss, headaches, rashes. I could go on and on. The way the silicone affects the body, I have no doubt whatsoever, more things will go wrong. The silicone affects the primary organs of the body. We have no way to rid our bodies of it, and implants don't need to be ruptured for one to become ill. Most everyone has heard of the proposed global settlement. The key word is proposed. Now that Dow Corning has some indication as to the number of women affected, they have filed bankruptcy. Even if they had not, the numbers of women are so staggering, there will not be enough to pay the women for their level of disease. They anticipated this even in the proposition stage. By the end of this month, we should have a revised settlement grid. We will be asked a second and final time if we wish to remain in the settlement or opt out. This will be a blind opt out, meaning we are supposed to determine if we think we will receive a reasonable settlement based on the level of our illness and the number of women participating, which will cause a drastic ratcheting down in our settlement amount. It has been hinted that figures may be as little as 5% of what we were originally entitled to according to the grid. 5% won't even cover our medical expenses, not to mention the fact that most of us are no longer able to work due to our illness, and this has created a severe hardship in most cases. If we opt out due to revised figures and the ratcheting down, and if we can afford to pursue it individually, placing a cap on settlement amount would drastically affect us. I am only 36 years old. I have to live the rest of my life, however long that might be, like this, and without question, progressively getting worse. My entire back is swollen all the time, and the severe pain is chronic. And pain medication doesn't help at all, other than to make me not care how bad I hurt. I urge you not to pass this bill. Nothing can ever repay us or our families for the pain, suffering, and fear felt at the hands of big business, who knew all along what they were doing was harmful. Breast implants are not the only harmful silicone product being placed in the body. My doctor tended to treat me in less than a serious manner until one of his male patients with a penile implant started to display the same symptoms I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Beach. We also heard from some members of that same group in Sitka, and so thank you very much.
Thank you.
From Matsu, we have David Golter.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, my name is Dave Golter. I'm an attorney here in the Valley. I've been practicing for about 11 years. The majority of my practice does not involve personal injury, so I don't stand to lose or gain a great deal from whether this bill passes or fails. However, I have reviewed the VIP bill, and I do feel very strongly about it, and I wanted an opportunity to at least express how I felt about it. There's a great deal that I could say, but I understand that time is somewhat limited, and I anticipated that, and would like to focus primarily on one facet of the bill, and that is the punitive damage cap. Punitive damages are one of the very few ways that an individual citizen can exert leverage on insurance companies, large organizations, and so forth. Those damages are one way, and perhaps the only way, that we have of leveling playing field between the individual and the large organization. I believe there's been previous testimony that to the effect that punitive damages are very rare. Certainly, in my limited experience anyway, I'm not aware of any situation in which there has been a punitive damage award. There was one exception where the statute required treble damages. But the punitive damage we're talking about in this bill, I've never seen, and I'm not aware that it has been awarded in the Valley anyway. I certainly haven't heard of them. So I believe that they are very rare. But more importantly is the threat of punitive damage. The threat of punitive damage, I believe, makes a real difference in the way that businesses conduct themselves. We've heard some testimony this morning about insurance companies and the way that they handle claims. We've also heard some concerns expressed about the cost of litigation. The punitive damage possibility in the state of Alaska, I believe, is one of the reasons that claims are not handled worse than they are, frankly. That insurance companies do understand that if they go too far, they do face a bad faith claim, and they do face large punitive damages.
Yes.
And it's because of that they give the attention that they do give to the cases that they have. Without that threat, there is absolutely no reason why an insurance company should devote any time or effort to a settlement of a claim by someone other than their insured. They the cap that has been provided here is a $300,000 cap. Now, $300,000 is nothing to Allstate or State Farm. That's petty tax. And I don't believe that we're naive enough to believe that $300,000 is any kind of a deterrent whatsoever to one of these corporations. They figure that in as cost of doing business. And the number of claims that they settle, if they can discourage even a small percentage of the claims by not settling them, by stonewalling, they can save far more than the $300,000 that they might face in the rare case where they're called to task over their approach. There is a lot of talk these days about limiting the role of government in the lives of individuals and rolling back regulations and so on. I personally believe that's a good thing. But as we do that, the role of punitive damages becomes even more important because it allows the individual then to do something when the large corporations do not act responsibly. I think we're all understanding that there are limits to what government can do in protecting people, but the punitive damage award is absolutely essential when companies abuse the freedom and the privilege that they're seeking at this point. We need to remember that punitive damages are only awarded in the case of outrageous behavior. And when there is, in fact, outrageous behavior, then it is justified to award a punitive damage. The amount of the punitive damage has to be an amount that will have an effect. Otherwise, the whole purpose of punitive damages is simply lost. If you cannot get punitive damages beyond $300,000, then there is no purpose to that when you're dealing with a multi-billion dollar corporation. There is no question in reading this bill that the bill takes away or limits the rights of citizens of Alaska. I think even the people who support it would have to acknowledge that it does take away certain rights of the citizens. So I guess the first and obvious question is why? Why are we doing that? I am not aware, and I'm certainly not aware of everything that's been done, studies and so on, but I certainly haven't heard anything this morning that indicates that there's any particular need for the strong measures that are being proposed here. I suggest that unless there's strong evidence that the benefit to our citizens, not to the insurance companies and large corporations, but the benefit to our citizens outweighs the hardship of the loss of their rights, the answer is obvious. The bill should not pass. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to now move back again to the Anchorage area. We've had people that took the time to come in to this meeting, which was scheduled for this place and time, and I want to give them the opportunity to work on through. We're going to have to extend the hearing because of the tremendous number of witnesses and interest in the bill. Kirsten Tilling, or Tinglem? I'm sorry, I'm saying that all wrong.
You're really close, though.
This is Tinglem.
Go right ahead. Yeah, you swear to tell the truth, whole truth, not what the truth is.
I do.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
My name is Kirsten Tinglem. I'm chair of the Alaska Action Trust, and I'm a lawyer here in Anchorage with the firm of Ashburn & Mason. It's a small firm. I'm the only lawyer in the firm that does personal injury work. Like Mr. Feldman, I also do other kinds of legal work. I represent public utilities and small businesses and larger businesses in Alaska. I also do defense work. I enjoy doing personal injury work because it is one place where ordinary people, in their individual capacities, like everybody sitting in this room, needs help working with much bigger, more powerful entities. One thing that all of my personal injury clients have in common is that they come to my office embarrassed and humiliated. First, they're embarrassed and humiliated because they're not getting better. They've been injured, and all their lives they've worked hard. They're like the people in this room. They've worked hard, they go to the doctor, they follow instructions, they get better. Usually, if they've had to come see me, they've been in an accident and they're not getting better. And they're embarrassed by that. The other reason they're embarrassed and humiliated is that they've reached the point where nobody's believing them. The insurance company isn't taking their word for it anymore and is questioning them and isn't paying. And that's embarrassing and humiliating to them, too, because all their lives they've paid their insurance be representing the person that they're suing. And so they are embarrassed and humiliated that this company with which they've done business for 15 or 20 years doesn't believe them. And finally, they're embarrassed and humiliated because they've had to come see a lawyer. They don't even like being in my office, and they usually spend the first half hour apologizing for even being there. So to the extent that somehow people have the idea that plaintiffs, personal injury plaintiffs, are these greedy, rapacious people out to get something for nothing, my experience has been the opposite. They are embarrassed and ashamed to even be in the system. I would like to specifically address a provision today that will drastically affect the kind of client I'm talking about, the ordinary middle-class person who's been injured in an accident and the system is not working for them. And the provision I'd like to address is the offer of judgment rule, which is Section 13 of the bill. Normally what happens in these cases is either the liability, the fact that it was someone else's fault is not at issue. It usually, these cases that I take, liability is clear. Someone ran a red light, someone, you know, didn't stop and ran into them. The liability is clear. It was clearly someone else's fault. But what's happening is either they're not getting better and people aren't believing that they need the treatment that they need, or they're disputing the causation. Oh, this accident couldn't possibly have put you in the condition that you're in. So that's what we're fighting. They usually go about 2 years, during which time there are depositions and the other side hires expensive outside experts to say that the accident couldn't possibly have caused it, and we have to hire other experts. And after 2 years, usually the case settles, and it settles like this. These people will get back, will finally have proved through their efforts and my efforts that, yes, the injury is legitimate. It was caused by the accident. Their medical expenses are legitimate. And they will be offered something just before trial that basically covers those medical expenses. There'll be an additional amount, which goes to pay me, usually, and what they walk away with is enough money to pay their doctors. I don't get rich. I'm under oath. I usually make on these cases about my hourly rate, if I'm brave enough to do the assessment. They walk away with enough money to cover their medicals. They do not walk away with their pockets bulging with cash. But it's been worthwhile because they needed to convince somebody that their claims were legitimate and they needed to get that treatment, and that's what they go through to get the treatment. Now, the proposed offer of judgment rule would make it impossible for these people to go through this very simple, basic process, because what it proposes to do, now let me tell you what an offer of judgment is. It's basically just a settlement offer that's made officially on a piece of paper called an offer of judgment. The rule already exists, and this is the way it works. If the defense gives me an offer of judgment, a settlement offer, I have 10 days to accept or reject it. If I reject it, or if I don't answer it, it's deemed rejected. My client, and I do worse at trial than that settlement offer, my client pays a small penalty in the form of interest adjustments. So there's a slap on the wrist for refusing an offer of judgment that later turns out to have been what the jury awards. Okay. There is also in place right now, in addition to that offer of judgment rule, Rule 82, which is a much more significant consequence for a party that fails to settle. And the way Rule 82 works is that if I go to trial, my client goes to trial, and they lose, they will pay a portion of the other side's attorney's fees. In a case that's worth about $100,000, that might be about $15,000 that they would have to pay. Okay, $15,000, I dare say, for anybody in this room, gives people pause. I mean, it's usually about the size of people's entire savings account. And if I tell them before trial, you know, if you lose, if for some reason your doctors aren't believed, or you aren't believed, or that other expert from California is believed, and you lose, you will have to pay the other side's attorney's fees under Rule 82, a portion of them. And it will be, and I can usually calculate it under the rule, but say in a typical case, about $15,000. Plus, don't forget, you'll have to also pay for the experts that we've hired so far, which is usually, in my cases, in the realm of about $5,000. So that's $20,000 you'll be out. That, the way that rule, and that's the way the rule's working right now, believe me, it is a significant motivator to get people to settle. That's their life savings they're talking about. And if the settlement is at all within the realm of reason, given that hammer, if they lose, they will settle the case. That is working. I mean, I'm under oath. That rule works. It gets people to settle cases. Now, under the proposed offer of judgment rule, Section 13, if I get a settlement offer at any time in the case, and I can tell you if this passes, the offers of judgment will come right when the answer is filed. Any time in the case, I get a settlement offer. I have 10 days to evaluate it. If I evaluate it and reject it, and the other side, the defense, does better at trial by just 5% or more, I could still win the case. We could still win. But if their projection, if I'm off by 5% or more, my client pays actual attorney's fees from the date of that offer. Actual attorney's fees. So that means it's the beginning of a 2-year case. We get an offer of judgment. I know, and my client knows, what their doctors have told them about their condition. They don't know what the other experts are going to say. They don't know what the other side's arguments are. They can believe their doctors. They get a settlement offer. It looks terrible. But I have to tell them at that point, all right, they're offering you some money. It's not nearly enough. It's not what your doctors have said. But I have to tell you this. If you reject it, and we go all the way through trial, and we're talking 2 years of defense costs, so we're talking definitely over $50,000, maybe close to $100,000 of their attorney's fees, and we're off. You could win at trial, but if we're off, if we get 5% or more less than what they've offered, you will owe them that entire sum, $50,000 to $100,000. Now, what person in this room is going to take that risk? That's your home. That's not your savings account. That's your home. That's generally your lifetime earnings, or at least your net worth. Nobody can take that risk. And I'll tell you this, the people that it's going to affect are the people sitting in this room, the people who work for a wage or a salary, the people who earn their living through their work, who own a home, who have something to lose. It's not going to affect destitute people. If they have a $100,000 judgment against them, they go into bankruptcy and nothing's lost. It's not going to affect the very, very wealthy, because while nobody would want to pay $100,000, there are certainly corporations out there who could take the hit. They're not going to lose their homes. They're not going to be in bankruptcy. But you and I and everybody in this room could not afford to take that risk. It's a devastating provision, and it's aimed right at the middle class, and it will help nobody. It does not help the system, and it hurts the people who are most tied to playing fairly in the system. If you think about it, you might think of other scenarios. There's always a chance to settle a case before the end. So if, you know, these things could be adjusted. But another thing I think that would happen is, as I explained to you, the way these cases usually come out is that after 2 years, we've managed to prove to the other side that, yes, indeed, this injury was caused by the accident, and it's as bad as it looks, and their medical expenses should be covered. The offer we get usually covers that plus a little more, because insurance company has figured that, well, that'll pay their lawyer and they'll have their medical, so they'll take this offer. It's basically a reasonable offer. Nobody's making any extra money. What this would do is, if I were an insurance defense lawyer a week before trial, I would offer just the medical expenses, okay? Because then I, plaintiff's lawyer, I'm going to have to say, look, they've offered you the $50,000 you've spent on medical expenses. You're going to have to give me a third of that. That's our deal. So you're not going to have enough to cover. But I got to tell you this. If we go to trial and we're off by 5%, if our $50,000, if the jury awards 42 or 40 even if we win, you're out their actual attorney's fees. And if we're a week before trial and we're talking about 2 weeks, you're out $25,000 or $30,000. You know, it not only makes it impossible to play the game from the get-go, even for a client who's willing to hang in there, who's so outraged or so injured that they don't have a choice but to stay in and gut it out. There will be no such thing as a fair settlement offer at the end, because nobody in their right mind will go to trial if they're offered anything. Please take a look at Section 13. It's a good number for that section. It shouldn't be in this bill. It hurts exactly the kind of people I think you are here trying to protect, which is ordinary, hardworking people who get pulled into the system, usually not voluntarily. Thank you.
Question? Thank you very much. Bradley Penn, Marathon Oil.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a written statement to submit.
Thank you very much. Kim Daniels. You're just here to, you're sitting by, okay. Is it Beverly Napagee? That's observer only also. Bob Nessel?
Be back here. Oh, thank God. Okay, I'll hold on my left hand because the right one doesn't work.
You swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, not the truth, help God.
I do, sir.
Please go ahead.
Senators, I get very many insurance magazines because I am a former insurance broker and former company employee. And I think that this copy of National Underwriter, which I believe Mr. Senator Taylor, your office has received a copy of. I'll give you this copy. It says, insurers shall profit for the first quarter of this year. And they list the gross profit of the companies. They show net premiums written, net premiums earned, and they go all through it. And if you believe anything an insurance company tells you, you're bigger fools than anybody ever thought. Insurance companies are taught to lie. It's kind of like being a member of the LAPD. You have to learn how to lie. Having worked for them for 10 years before I became an insurance broker 31 years ago, I found that what they say and what the change they've got in their pockets are two different things. And I'll tell you that I'm glad I'm out of the insurance brokerage business, but I'm especially glad I'm out of the insurance company employee end of it. We were taught to believe what the company said was right. You know, we were sitting in there as underwriters or as field men, and handed down from on high were the information that we should believe. I sat with one of the insurance companies I worked for. I was called to the office in October, and at that time we determined the the loss ratio we would have as of December 31. Now, this was primarily on fire insurance, but also as it was on automobile insurance. It was very simple. We were a mutual company rather than a stock company. We were told what loss ratios we wanted for this territory or for this company. That's what we came up with, surprisingly, all the time. Never missed it by more than, maybe 1 or 2%. Nothing was actual. It was a guess, a stab in the dark, and that's the way it went. I would like to leave you this magazine to look through and to read, and I think you'll find it very interesting. I like the comments that you had previously here, and I think that your action on this can go long and hard, but I don't believe there's any reason to pass this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience, too, Bob. Wait. Rick Friedman? Swear to tell the truth, whole truth, not but truth, help you out.
I do.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
Thank you. My name is Rick Friedman. I've practiced law in Sitka and in Anchorage for approximately 16 years, primarily representing what Kirsten said, sort of the average person who's been sucked into the litigation process involuntarily. I wanted to address two separate subjects. The first is one raised by Senator Miller in your questions earlier about what can we do to see that more money gets to the right people. I think those figures you cited are probably close to accurate if they include the money going to defense. Couple things you can do. You can raise prejudgment interest rates so that there's not an incentive to delay the case from the defense side. They don't get to hold on to their money. You can fund the judicial system so there's not as much of a backlog. You can cap the amount the defense is allowed to spend defending cases. Now, I doubt if any of the tort reformers will come in and tell you that's a good idea, but if you think about it, if they don't have money to spend, you know, I've had cases where really only $100,000 was an issue, and the defense has spent $150,000 to $200,000 defending, ultimately paying us the $100,000. Now, we don't benefit from that litigation. We contingency lawyers have lost money on that deal. The only one who's benefited is the defense lawyer. I don't have all the answers to how you can, and there may not be an answer, I think. You know, we've got this sort of free enterprise system where person X has been injured, and he comes in and says, Corporation A, you owe me $1 million. Corporation A is not going to turn over $1 million without a fight, no matter how good the claim is. They just don't do it, and I don't know that there's anything you can do to change that. What I can tell you is this bill will act in the opposite direction. Let's take, for example, the caps on non-economic damages. If the defendant, the institutional defendant, knows that there's a cap, the worst that can happen by going to trial is X number of dollars, then they've got more incentive to roll the dice, to see how it's going to play its way out. And that's what you find, for example, in areas like ERISA, where Congress has stepped in and said, if you've got a health insurance policy issued by certain private companies, you can't get punitive damages. And what we're seeing all over the country, it's a national scandal, is that these health insurance companies, no longer faced with the threat of punitive damages, have been denying valid claims left and right. And what they know is that if they lose, all they have to pay is what they owe under the policy anyway. The worst that's going to happen is that they're going to pay the obligation that they had in the beginning. And maybe the person will die in the meantime and they won't have to do anything. And I've personally been involved in two cases where women were seeking bone marrow transplants that were clearly covered under their policies, and the health insurance companies wouldn't pay. And in one of the cases, between the lines, the opposing lawyer told me, you know, if she dies before this litigation is over, we won't have to pay for the procedure, we won't have to pay for anything. That's where the economic incentives are. In ERISA, those are the sort of economic incentives that would be put in place by this sort of bill. What I came prepared to talk to you about today was the subject of punitive damages. And rather than talk about the McDonald's case or cases we've heard around the country, I'd like to tell you about a couple cases that I've been involved in personally. I feel convinced that those of you who are in favor of tort reform, if you were to sit on the juries in these cases, would be convinced that more than $300,000 was appropriate in punitive damages. The very first punitive damage case I had involved an insurance company that decided to, in its own words, institute a get-tough policy with its own insurance policy holders. What they wanted to do is bring their ratios down, as the gentleman ahead of me talked about. They had certain targets in mind, and so they were going to get tough. And what that meant was that they were going to contest claims made by their policyholders in a much more stringent way than they had in the past. And one of two things would happen. Either the people would cave in and accept less than their claim was worth, or they would have to go through arbitration to get what their claim was worth. I represented a woman who did just that. It cost her something in the neighborhood of $12,000 in attorney's fees to recover, ultimately, I think it was $20,000 that she was due for her claim. It wasn't a major claim. She had some medical expenses. She had some lost time from work. She was put through the ringer for 2 years to recover that $20,000, including spending roughly $12,000 of her own money. The experts calculated that this company in Anchorage alone, by instituting that policy, saved $1.2 million a year. This was the only woman who, or the only person, faced with this policy who, after it was over, decided she was going to sue to punish the company and make them accountable. Took her another 2.5 years to get to trial. The jury, hearing all the evidence, punished State Farm Insurance Company, a multi-billion dollar company, to the tune of $1.2 million. 1 year's profit from their Get Tough policy. So they're still millions of dollars ahead from their from what they did. You reduce that risk and make it $300,000, all you do is add economic incentive for that sort of behavior. I represented the estate of a 26-year-old logger. He worked for, or was injured, ultimately killed. He was run over by a truck with no backup alarm. The company that owned the truck had been warned by OSHA several times to put backup alarms on its equipment. It didn't do it. It was warned by its own insurance company that it needed to put backup alarms on its equipment. It didn't do it. The result was that this 26-year-old young man was run over and killed. The result was an OSHA fine for the company of $1,250. The companies, the economic forces that are at work in this state are huge, and they're powerful. And they don't always do bad things. They often do good things. But when they do bad things, what you see is the sort of human misery that Mr. Sweet was talking about, that Mr. Callow showed you on the video. We can't bring in these people. If you could see person after person after person and family after family that was ruined, I think you'd have a different view of some of these provisions. The irony of the backup alarm case, well, it's not, I don't know if it's an irony, it's a sadness, is the head of the logging camp where this individual was killed went on 4 or 5 months later to work at another logging camp, and roughly a month after he started working there, another young man was killed, run over by a piece of equipment with an inoperable backup alarm. These economic forces do not fear government regulation. They do not fear the legislature. They do not fear public opinion. What they fear is coming in front of 12 regular fair-minded people and having their conduct exposed and having that jury decide what a fair punishment is. And what they want, and that's why they're here asking you for it, is a cap. Tell us that if no matter how bad we are, no matter how many people we hurt, we kill, we maim, that the worst penalty we can suffer is $300,000. And I suspect if there was a criminal lobby, you'd have criminals in here lobbying you saying, tell us that the worst sentence we can have is 3 years in jail. It's the same sort of thing. What they want is a license. License that will cost them no more than $300,000. I represent a woman who was a witness to a crime. She didn't want to testify. She was afraid there would be retaliation by the person who committed the crime. She testified in grand jury. The criminal got out. He tracked her down. He stalked her. He raped her. He put, he did just very terrible things to her. And under your provision, the worst that person can be punished is $300,000. he's not going to be prosecuted by the state because of problems with the evidence and the way it was stored. So the worse that person who did, I can't even talk about some of the things he did to her, the worst he can be punished under your provision is $300,000. We've got doctors or hospitals. Suppose, we don't know, but suppose Providence Hospital destroyed Mr. Sweet's son's medical records. This multi-billion dollar corporation is looking at a serious malpractice claim, and they, let's suppose, we don't know, but suppose they destroyed those medical records. The worst they risk by doing that and getting caught is $300,000. When you make a bright line determination and you say, no matter how bad the case, no matter how wealthy the defendant, $300,000 is a fair punishment, you are attributing to yourselves an enormous amount of wisdom, an enormous amount of insight and prescience. And I would suggest to you that sitting here today, you're not in a position to know who the next Ford Pinto victims are going to be, who the next Dalcon Shield victims are going to be, what next, frankly, atrocity is going to be committed by a powerful economic interest. And to sit here and pass judgment and say $300,000 is always sufficient punishment is laughable. What you'll be doing is giving them a license. Thank you.
Rod, you're just, Rod Wilson, you're just observing. John Wheatley.
Where I tell the truth, the whole truth, and let the truth help God.
I do.
Thank you. John, go right ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on an issue important to the people and important to the business and state of Alaska. My name, for the record, is John Wheatley. I'm president and CEO of Willis Groom Corporation. It's a insurance brokerage firm that employs approximately 50 people in the state of Alaska with offices in Anchorage and Fairbanks. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 158. And my comments are brief. I know time is running short, so I will be very brief.
John, if you could just speak up a little bit. Sure. We're even having a hard time hearing you down here. You have a very gentle, soft voice. So.
I will. Okay, thank you. I will be brief. I know your time is short. Couple of comments. Just as the penalty for every crime is pre-established in criminal law, punitive damages should be based on a preset multiple of actual damages. Since punitive damages are intended as punishment, they should be assessed when malicious intent or willful negligence is proven. This bill allows juries to be told of awards already collected by the plaintiff, and previous awards will be deducted from any subsequent judgment. And joint and several liability in this bill is modified so that each defendant only pays based upon his proportionate share of liability for injury or property damage. My understanding of the purpose of House Bill 158 is to create a more equitable distribution of costs, reduce costs, eliminate duplicate recoveries, establish thresholds for damage awards, stabilize cost of health care, and require one half of punitive damages awarded by the court deposited to the general fund for the welfare of the public. To this end, we're in support of House Bill 158.
John, I had a question for you.
Sure.
Part of your written comment there was you said this bill, and I was writing probably too fast, this bill would allow the jury to be told of previously awarded judgments?
My understanding is that this bill allows juries to be told of awards already collected by the plaintiff.
Awards. I think that's, is that the collateral source provision that you're
referring
to? I
believe so.
Could you just tell me why the wrongdoer should receive the benefit of the collateral source? I mean, your child's injured, you have to take care of your child, and you pay the money for your child's medical benefits. Why should the collateral source apply and the wrongdoer who drove over your child be able to deduct that from the amount that's owed to you?
I think the intent, and perhaps maybe it is misworded in the actual bill, but the intent, I believe, is to avoid duplicate payments from third parties. That's my understanding, and maybe I'm misunderstanding.
I obviously used the wrong hypothetical then. Let me try a different one. You may not carry this, but many professionals do, a form of insurance that if you're injured in some fashion and unable to show up for work, your compensation or a percentage of your compensation based on that policy would be paid to you during the period of your disability and inability to show up for work. The drunk driver smucks into you this afternoon, that policy kicks in a year and a half later when your policy has still been paying you some amount of your wages per month. That's a collateral source under this law. The drunk driver now has the benefit of deducting from whatever amount he owes you the amount of money that your collateral source paid to you. As an insurance person, why would you ever want to do that? I mean, there's no incentive for me to buy insurance.
As the plaintiff, I would be entitled to be made whole. And I think that's what this part is trying to address, is allowing the plaintiff to be made whole as opposed to be made more than whole.
But your carrier that you paid the premiums for the last 20 years, is the one that you had the contract with to pay you in case of an accident that resulted in your inability to work. You did no wrong. Why should the wrongdoer, this drunk who negligently smashed into you, why should he now receive the benefit of your policy? Because under this law, you would not be subrogated. Your company, who paid you all this money, couldn't even sue the drunk to get the money back. What in the world does that have to do with individual responsibility and with... I mean, I'm having a real hard time with that provision, and I've asked each of the insurance people that I assume must have played some role in the drafting of this thing, why would you ever do that?
Well, your point is well taken, and perhaps it could be crafted in a little different way in terms of the wording of that, because I don't think the intent, as I understand it, but I think the intent is to... create a wholeness rather than a more than wholeness, and the way that is distributed perhaps could be crafted a little differently, but that was the intent of that, as I understand it.
Okay, good. So the intent was that there only be a payment for the totality of the injury suffered, period.
Correct.
And that you're then kind of lump summing the monies that come in from the other collateral sources, so that I guess the part I'm not understanding, do the parties still have the right to go back against the wrongdoer, the insurance company, the workers' comp carrier, the mom and dad who had to take care of their 25-year-old son when they got injured and help pay his cost? Do mom and dad then have a right to sue the wrongdoer themselves?
I'm not an expert in the legal field, but my understanding of the way many insurance claims issues work is that insurance companies subrogate all the time. So I think the intent is for wholeness of distribution as opposed to partial.
Well, you're the second person to testify before the committee, in my recollection, that somehow people make more money off of a claim than they're entitled to. That somehow there's a doubling occurs because of collateral source. Mm-hmm. Has that been your experience in the insurance field, that this does occur?
I've had no personal experience.
You've had no personal experience?
No personal experience.
Are you aware of situations like that where people have somehow, I don't know how they do it exactly without committing a felony. I mean, it's fraud, and if it's over $500, it's a felony, I think, in this state. In other words, maybe you had three policies, so you fill out all three policies on your wrecked car, and so you get paid three times the value of your car by fraudulently lying to your insurance company, and that this is somehow a major problem that we should address through this collateral source rule. Have you experienced that?
Personally, I have not.
I haven't either. I've been practicing law now 25, 26 years. I've never seen that either. But I'm told, by we had one other witness that said that was common, that people would somehow get some kind of multiple or additional benefit. So, well, I'm glad to hear that your experience is like mine, and I appreciate very much the you believe the intent of that provision to be, and we'll do what we can here to make sure that that is carried out, that that is the intent. Thank you. John, that was the end of one full page. So. Dick, you're up. Dick Catnaugh. Swear to tell the truth, whole truth, nothing but the truth, help you God.
Yes, sir.
Before you get started on your formal presentation, I was watching body language, is something I pay attention to. During Mr. Friedman's comments, and you may not have made any notes on this, but he was commenting about punitive damages, and he gave some rather egregious hypothetical situations, and then said that would be worth $300,000, and you were shaking your head no. So I thought I might give you a chance to address that first before you started on your
Well, I appreciate that, because I certainly am not an attorney, and I guess maybe the way I read some of this is different than the way others may read this, but punitive damages section says that the amount of punitive damages awarded by a court or jury under A of this section may not exceed three times the amount of compensatory damages awarded, or $300,000, whichever amount is greater. Now, the only time $300,000 would come in as the limit is if the compensatory damages were under $100,000. If the compensatory damages exceed $100,000, $500,000, let's say, then the punitive damages would be $1.5 million, three times. But they would never be less than $300,000. Now, the way I understood it being stated was that $300,000 was the limit. The way this section, Section 7, is written, $300,000 is the minimum.
Oh, I've already read it that way, too. Go right ahead.
Okay, so that's the body language you were reading was correct. I was disagreeing with the statement, but I'm not an attorney, and he's an attorney, so maybe there's something I don't understand about that simple 2.5 lines.
So. Yeah. I interrupted your presentation.
No, that's all right.
I wanted to give you a shot.
The understanding and the intent is exactly as I stated. And if that is not the way it comes across, then it should be changed so that that is, in fact, the way the bill might come across. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to discuss the merits of House Bill 158. My name is Richard Catnaugh, Vice President of Unit Company, an Alaska contractor located in Anchorage. I'm here today testifying on behalf of Alaskans for Liability Reform. I would first like to explain the philosophy of our group and our rationale for supporting the bill before you. It is our belief that the civil justice system is an inefficient system that must be reformed if the residents of the states are to become more efficient and effective. To our group, being more efficient means getting more money to the injured party while reducing the total cost involved in the case. We believe that House Bill 158 has presented many suggestions that can help achieve that goal. To illustrate how inefficient the civil justice system is, I would like to quote from a study prepared by Towers Perrin, a national consulting firm dealing primarily in the area of personnel matters. Their study dealt with a portion of total premium dollars returned to the beneficiaries. With Social Security, 99% of the premium dollars are returned to beneficiaries. Health insurance, it's 85%.
Workers' compensation at 70%. Torts, less than 50%. These statistics clearly illustrate that the civil justice system in this country is not working in the best interest of the plaintiff or the defendant, rather structured to serve the interest of other parties involved in the process. House Bill 158 attempts to remedy some of the problems that exist in the current system and improve the efficiency of the system. It has attempted to reach a balance between the plaintiff and the defendant so that both parties are treated fairly under the law. House Bill 158 attempts to, 1, establish a reasonable statute of repose so that the defendant can marshal the documents and personnel essential to adequately defend their actions. Imagine, if you will, trying to defend what you might have done 15, 17, 20 years ago in a court of law and having to rely on witnesses long dead, records that you can no longer find, and you're up there testifying and trying to recall exactly what you did on what dates and on projects you probably don't even remember doing. 2, establish a reasonable time limit for actions against medical providers. 3, establish a limit on non-economic damages. 4, establish a limit on punitive damages and the distribution of such damages. 5, establish a need to itemize damages between non-economic losses and economic losses. 6, establish the ability to utilize periodic payments to pay damages. 7, establish the recognition of collateral benefits. 8, establish the concept of joint and several liability, or reestablish the concept of joint and several liability. 9, modify the current practice of offers of judgment. 10, modify the determination of prejudgment interest. 11, establish standards for the determination of expert witnesses. 12, establish a framework for dealing with civil liability of hospitals for non-employees. We believe that House Bill 158 is a reasonable compromise between opponents and proponents of tort reform. We commend the committee for their work on this issue and urge passage of 158. I would also like to, at this time, point out a few things that have come up in earlier testimony. The first is an item that came out of the American Law Institute, and I'm sure you're very familiar with that. That's a subsidiary of the American Bar Association. In talking about tort reform, they make the comment that meaningful guidelines should be developed to assist juries in assessing such damages. The guidelines should be based on a scale of inflation-adjusted damage amounts attached to the number or to a number of disability profiles that range from the relative moderate to the gravest of injuries. I think it's an injustice when people with similar injuries receive greatly different amounts of money. And I think that's something, we look at the civil justice system, we look at the workers' comp system, and the workers' comp system we all know is not perfect. But there, when somebody's injured, the parties pretty well know what's going to be paid, when it's going to be paid, and that system functions quite well.
There's just for a second.
Yes.
I want you to really know how well this workers' comp system is working right now. I want you to pick up a phone today in Alaska and find me any attorney that will represent an injured workers' comp person other than Chancey Croft right here in town. Because I tried last week, Dick. I couldn't find anybody in southeast Alaska that would take a case. I've never represented these people. I don't know anything about that law. All I know is the legislature, with the assistance of the insurance industry, the construction industry, the trade unions, and a pat little group they put together up here last year, has now come up with a law that nobody can hire an attorney to enforce. And as a consequence, the two people who called me last week, both of them had been denied benefits and had absolutely nowhere to turn. Both of them been out of work, and they're on unemployment and looking at food stamps. We got a nice system going now that I'm sure everybody's real happy with. But I'll guarantee you can't find anybody out there that'll take a case.
Mr. Chairman, that of course is not the way the system should be working.
That's right.
and we have a division of the workers' comp, and if these people ask for a hearing, they get a hearing, and it's an impartial hearing comprised of one member of labor, one member of management, and supposedly the hearing officer, which is a member of the, or is an employee of the division. They hear the case,
yeah,
they
who
render
shows
a decision.
Up there, Dick? You know it as well as I do. Who shows up?
Well, who shows up? Usually it's the
attorney
plaintiff
on behalf of the insurance company for the employer. He's a specialist in workers' comp. He shows up on one side. Who now shows up on the other side? The busted up truck driver.
And if you've sat in any of those hearings, you know as well as I do that they don't give much credence to attorneys.
Well, that may be, Dick. All I'm getting at is the system up for the last 30 years that I've watched it has at least worked. The worst of those cases could at least go find an attorney and get some representation. Anymore, as an attorney, I can't even find anybody to take the case for these guys. I don't know if it's a good case or a bad case. I can't even find anybody willing to look at it. That's how efficient that system's working. And what is happening is somebody's sitting back and saying, you know, if we only dock about 10% of these cases, we can make a whole bunch more this next year.
I don't know if that's rationale or not, but
I don't either. It's an economic decision,
but
though. It's not a decision based on anything else.
The thing about the workers' comp system is that when a person's injured, the law requires automatically they start getting their compensation. They automatically get their medical benefits. If they qualify, they automatically get their vocational rehabilitation. If they're disabled, they automatically, you can determine how much they're going to get for their disability. All of that can be done. It doesn't have to be litigated. It is all in the legislation and the regulation.
Agreed. It only has to be litigated when somebody denies those benefits.
That's right.
And then we have to go forward. And I'm just saying that part of that system doesn't seem to be working to me real good right now, and we may have to reassess that thing.
Maybe.
But let's get back to your something. You were just using
the point,
that as an analogy.
I was using that as an analogy because we define there what a person can re-